the portfolio committee and the officials, including the guests, the media. We are gathered here today to get a briefing from the Minister of Public Enterprises on the ESCOM special paper, and then we take it from there and engage that particular input. But I'm having first a list of apologies which the Secretary is supposed to take us through.
Good morning, members and chairperson. The apologies I've received is for the Deputy Minister, Mr. Kwankwa, Ms. Maotwe, and I think Ms. Piri will be joining us late.
Morning, Chairperson, and morning, honourable members and guests. I think, firstly, apologies on behalf of the Minister. He is still at Cabinet, but he will be joining this meeting as soon as he's able to excuse himself. In the meantime, I will start with today's presentation, and I think, Chair, you will guide on how to proceed when the Minister arrives. I assume members have two documents in front of them, which is the full ESCOM paper and a summarized version, which is a presentation format which seeks to summarize the full 70 pages of the paper into a summarized slide. The presentation is quite lengthy, but I will try and stick to the key points in the paper. So this paper sets out the roadmap on the reform of ESCOM over the next year and beyond. So you have seen that in the last month, the Minister of Energy released the Integrated Resources Plan, which gives a guideline of how the energy mix in the country will evolve over the next 15 years up until 2030. We expect that the IRP will be revised on an ongoing basis, but we believe that this version gives us a quite sound base from which to plan for the sector going forward. So in terms of the reform, ESCOM is a dominant player across the entire electricity supply value chain. They are 95% of the generation market. They are about 45% of the distribution market and 100% of the transmission market. So the reform of ESCOM will inadvertently result in the reform of the electricity sector, which is what we are talking about in the paper. We will continue to rely on ESCOM for baseload power for a considerable period of time. If you look at the current fleet that is being constructed, you take Kusile as a base, it will be in existence for the next 50 years. So we will have coal and ESCOM generation for a considerable period of time. And given that, we have no option but to fix ESCOM in the current context in terms of their operational, financial and structural challenges. And at the same time, ESCOM itself must commence on a journey towards being a reliable, efficient provider of electricity well into the future. And the fixing of ESCOM's operational and financial performance is a key cornerstone in terms of resolving the economic recovery for the South African economy. The burning platform in terms of restructuring ESCOM, firstly, as a 95% provider of electricity, which is primarily coal, South Africa relies primarily on ESCOM for generation of power. And that if we do get this generation wrong, as we have seen, the impact on the economy is quite devastating. So what we have seen with the current load shedding is that ESCOM has an asset management problem, wherein the maintenance of the plant, if ESCOM gets it wrong across the whole fleet, Then we have the extent to which we've been having load shedding in recent days. From a structural perspective, we have sufficient capacity in the country to be able to meet the electricity demand, but we are not getting sufficient energy out of this plant due to poor performance. And as a result of the concentration of this generation in Eskom's hands, we are having the challenges that we have to rely on Eskom to fix itself in order for us to be able to recover. The second part is that the extent to which Eskom is a monopoly in the sector, we've had upward pressure in terms of electricity costs in the economy, which have contributed to the extent of deindustrialization in the country, and we have to deal with getting more competition in the generation sector so that we've got efficiencies that can be gained from having efficient competition. The third point is that Eskom poses a great, a big fiscal risk. And in terms of its inability to support economic growth and economic recovery, in terms of the inability to ensure security of supply. And Eskom's business model is being threatened in the sense that historically Eskom had a captive market, so there was one generation party and customers had to rely on Eskom, but we've increasingly seen that there are alternatives that are coming on stream and that are giving consumers alternatives in terms of making options, so making choices around alternative suppliers. And I think the extent to which Eskom's costs have grown and the extent to which alternative prices have come down are bringing Eskom's prices to parity with alternatives, and we've therefore seen the extent to which Eskom sales have been declining over the last decade, and that Eskom needs to rethink its business model, its competitiveness in terms of being able to defend its market share in terms of electricity suppliers. The fifth part is that Eskom presents a moral hazard for the fiscus in terms of the size of the company and the size of its balance sheet and the debts that it has. And I think as government, we often find ourselves with a gun to the head in terms of we have to bail out Eskom because we cannot contemplate the impact of allowing Eskom to fail. And I think this presents pervasive incentives for management not to change. And you would have seen it with the previous bailouts that have been afforded to Eskom, where we have not seen fundamental changes in the business in terms of reform or change in behavior in how the business is run. So the seventh point is that the size of Eskom's debt is at the 31st of March 2019, which is about 15% of GDP, and I think government has acknowledged that we have to take appropriate steps to support Eskom in dealing with the debt, but you would have seen in the MTPPS that the Minister of Finance was very clear that we acknowledge that we have to find a solution to Eskom's debt, but this must be preceded by a traction in operational and restructuring progress that the company must demonstrate. On the eighth point, we illustrate the point that Eskom has been bailed out. You'd recall that in 2007, Eskom was given 350 billion worth of guarantees, which remain in place. In 2015, and together with the guarantees, Eskom was given a 60 billion rand subordinated loan, which was subsequently converted to equity. We've had a 23 billion rand bailout in 2015, and now we're sitting in 2019 where we have to bail out Eskom to the extent that the Minister of Finance has already announced. And with all these bailouts, we always find ourselves at the same place because the fundamental issues with Eskom are not being dealt with, which is ensuring that revenue is growing, driven by sales and not prices, and secondly, ensuring that Eskom's cost base is dealt with effectively and that Eskom has a bearable levels of debt that it can service. On the next page, we paint a picture around what Eskom of the future will look like and what it will do. So in terms of the reform, Eskom will have three subsidiaries that are separate legal entities of generation, transmission, and distribution. There will also be a process to rationalize subsidiaries that Eskom has. So Eskom has several subsidiaries across the business, which include Eskom Finance Company, Eskom Enterprises, which itself has other subsidiaries within the portfolio. I think the process around rationalization will, one, be first to obtain focus on the core business of Eskom, but to also look at opportunities to raise additional funding in order to close the funding gap that Eskom has. In terms of the restructuring process, as announced by the president in the SONA, there is a prioritization in terms of ensuring that the transmission business is prioritized, and this is also to ensure that other independent players can also have unfettered access to the national grid, which is important as we embark on a process of increasing investments in generation as Eskom decommissions its own plants. There will be more detailed planning around creating intra-company competition within Eskom, which we have had in the past, in order to create efficiencies. But obviously for the competitive market to work within the generation space, there has to be sufficient capacity. So in a scenario where everybody is generating due to the poor performance and lack of excess power in the system, the competitive space doesn't quite work because everybody is dispatched. But as we anticipate improvement in generation performance, we expect that setting up intra-company competition will assist in ensuring that we have efficiencies in between the different players. And the next point is around Eskom must implement cost-saving measures with greater urgency, and we'll show in the subsequent slide the areas that must be that have been identified that must be executed. And then in the paper, we don't deal a lot with the challenges in distribution, but we do recognize that there are sufficient challenges or number of challenges within the distribution space, which include municipalities, affordability of customers that must be confronted and that require a more detailed strategy in terms of dealing with the extent to which municipalities are not viable, the extent to which municipalities and other customers, including government, are not paying for services, and how that challenge could potentially hinder the success around how this, the industry needs to operate going forward. From a governance perspective, I think you would have seen the appointment of the CEO, which would be the key driver in terms of the restructuring, and that in the short to medium term, the minister will be looking at appointing a board for the transmission to be able to drive this restructuring process. So in terms of solution, on the first part, I think it's important that as we talk about the restructuring, that we are able to address imminent issues that we currently have. The first one is around keeping the lights on. I think the system remains very constrained in the immediate term. We've seen an increase in plant breakdowns that have led to the load shedding that we had about 2 weeks ago. In terms of the summer plan that Eskom has communicated, if they are able to keep the plant breakdowns to 9,500 megawatts, we would be able to keep the lights on. I think it's important to highlight that even though Eskom says keeping the plant breakdowns below 9,500 megawatts, this is not an aspirational target. This extent of breakdowns is too big for an entity, and it says there are assets in Eskom that are not performing, and that the extent to which we allow the breakdowns to trend at close to 9,500 megawatt means that, you know, we are compromising areas around where we should be doing more predictive and planned maintenance to allow the plants to perform better. But so we track the plant performance, so the plant breakdowns at that level, but we do push Eskom to do better than the 9,500 megawatts, which represents significant capacity that is not available to for production. In support and in keeping focus on resolving operations, the minister has re-engaged the technical review team that was deployed last year to go back and re-audit the power plants in terms of the extent to which the recommendations from the technical review team have been implemented at power plant level, and to ensure and to have a greater focus at power plant level in terms of why specific stations are having the extent to which they are not performing. On the last part is that we recognize that even though the easiest lever in terms of ensuring security would be for Eskom to improve their plant performance, but in reality what we have seen is that Eskom has struggled to recover operational performance, and that we are having a conversation with the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy about acquiring additional levers in the short term in order to stabilize the system, and secondly to allow Eskom to have space to execute maintenance that's required, and hopefully get sustainability out of that process. So we are engaging with the policy department around a procurement framework that would allow a government or the Minister of Energy at least to procure the additional 2,000 megawatts of power that's required. This slide here tries to illustrate how the sector would work in terms of the flow of energy at the top, who sells to who, and at the bottom, how the money flows. And to go back to the point I was saying around the extent of distribution and the integrated strategy that is required, is that if this block around distribution doesn't work, therefore it would potentially affect whether the whole value chain or whether the whole industry would be viable without fundamentally fixing the issues around distribution. So there is a task team that is led by the Minister of COGTA in terms of dealing with municipal issues, and we see that as a critical block in terms of resolving the issues around distribution and ensuring that the entire value chain is sustainable. This next slide summarizes some of the issues that I've already raised. I'll only raise the one issue around climate change, which is on the just transition. And you will see in the subsequent slide related to the IRP the extent to which Eskom will retire plant over the next 10 years, and the impact on different communities where in these power plants are located. And the government is engaging together with Eskom and other stakeholders around a conversation of having a just transition that ensures that the impact on workers and impact on communities where these power plants are functioning is minimized, and that we try and we explore alternative economic activities for those areas in order to lessen the impact of that. The second part on the climate change is that in terms of the minimum emission standards, there are also challenges in terms of the extent to which Eskom is expected to comply. We are engaging with various authorities to ensure that at compliance next year, Eskom plants can retain their license to operate, which would potentially have an impact on security of supply. The next slide illustrates the integrated resource plan. I'll spend a few seconds on this slide that shows the extent to which the current base of coal will decline. So we're starting the base at about 37,100 megawatts, and by the end of 2030, we expect that to go down to about 33,000. And there will be additional capacity added, which would be the remaining units out of Medupi and Kusile, and the two coal IPPs that are expected to still come on load in 2023 and in 2027. So you will see a significant decline in coal, and that by 2030 we expect the share of cleaner sources of energy to increase in the energy mix in the country. This slide here demonstrates what the industry will look like, and the first part is the generation part would also then have other players, so we'll have an increase in terms of IPPs that are currently generating and other IPPs that are currently in the pipeline. The SAPP represents the extent of power that we do import from the region, primarily from Cahora Bassa in Mozambique and then other peaking plants. So the generation picture starts to change in terms of the extent to which Eskom is a dominant player and the emergence of other generation capacity. In terms of the transmission, these are the different functions that will then be in the transmission system. We expect that transmission will then sign power purchase agreement with the different generators on an indiscriminate basis. They will also have a system operation function, the operation of and maintenance of grid, including investment and expansion where required to connect other parties, and they would also then have supply agreements with different players, which would be the distribution of Eskom, municipalities, other large power users, and other regional customers to which we export power to. So this is just a simplified depiction of transmission and the different functions that will be in generation. I think on this slide is important to emphasize that the procurement of new energy in the short term will remain with the IPP office and the Minister of Energy, and in the long run we do expect that this function would be incorporated into an independent transmission entity which would have the real-time ability to buy and dispatch power. So this graph here shows the ambitious targets that we have put in terms of getting through this process. We expect that the functional unbundling should be completed at the end of this financial year, which is March 2020, and that the legal unbundling process should be completed by the end of 2021. I think we have put in this very aggressive targets because we do anticipate that we don't want to keep the entity in a state of uncertainty for a protected period of time. We would want to get through this unbundling process. We do anticipate that there might be challenges, but these are the targets that we are currently working with. So in terms of detail process, so at the top we try to illustrate the internal ESCOM processes that will be required in terms of enabling this. There is already progress in terms of relinking people at head office to line functions and ensuring that, one, it also allows the business to operate a lot more efficiently and not in the centralized structure where we've had operations have to rely on operations on head office in order for them to make procurement decisions and to make investment decisions. The second part talks to the legislative process. From where we sit, our understanding is that the in the creation of the three subsidiaries, there would not be any need to review the ESCOM Conversion Act, but we are getting a detailed legal opinion from senior counsel in order to give us assurance that our understanding and interpretation of the law is correct. On the last part, it deals more around the debt solution. You would recall that the Ministers of Public Enterprise and Finance appointed a CRO, and the CRO is considering the different debt options that would need to be finalized in order for us to have three sustainable subsidiaries. We expect the CRO to give a final report at the end of this year, and that a process or an announcement would be made by the Minister of Finance when he is satisfied that there is progress in terms of dealing with the fundamental issue around ESCOM. We know that market sentiment has been saying that, you know, the main thing is to deal with the ESCOM debt, but from where we sit, the restructuring of ESCOM is more about the restructuring of the sector and ensuring that the sector can be repositioned for growth and expansion. I think I've already spoken to the core functions of the transmission company in the earlier slide. Maybe to move to the generation subsidiary under generation would be that ESCOM is expected to retain its current fleet, and that each power station will then have a power purchase agreement. Each power station must have a clear view of what it takes to produce a unit of energy at every power plant. So the issue around having centralized costs where it's not clear where costs are allocated must end, so that it is clear how much each power plant spends in producing a unit energy. This becomes even more important as we talk about the entrance of other players with coal plants in the generation space, because they would want to know that the transmission entity does dispatch energy according to least cost, or they employ a merit order that uses the least cost, and therefore there has to be transparency around cost, and that ESCOM will also implement the retrofit of clean coal abatement technology, as I highlighted earlier on, to ensure that they do comply with the minimum emission standard, which is a license to operate. ESCOM is also expected to play a role in renewables going forward. You would know that ESCOM already has their own wind plant in Ferndale, and they also have other renewable installations across their various sites, and that they're doing a lot of research in terms of battery storage, and we do expect that they will play a significant role in battery storage technology going forward. So this is a summary of what the generation could look like with the different clusters that would stimulate intra-company competition, but to also create focus around improving performance per plant. So in terms of the restructuring process, we anticipate that this will drive further transparency in terms of operational costs. It will support economic growth in the country, because we will have a downward pressure on prices, and then we'll have further investments in this sector. It will increase competition in generation, which is important for efficiencies. It will provide a stable grid for the country, and it will drive compliance with environmental legislation as we see further a decline in the coal base of Eskom, and that it will promote innovation and entrepreneurship and an entrance of new players in the sector. From a financial perspective, I think Eskom remains the single largest risk to the fiscus. The declining electricity sales, as I have already alluded to earlier on, has been one of the key drivers in terms of Eskom's tariffs going up, and also customers opting for alternative supply of energy. The financial unsustainability of costs, so the costs driven by the extent to which Eskom's coal costs have escalated, the IPP costs out of the initial rounds that we have had, the cost in terms of debt servicing and capital that are due in the current year and peaking over the next few years. So it's important that we deal with the profile or the cost price, cost base of Eskom, to ensure that we are dealing with the problem fundamentally, and that it's not just about the bailout. The non-payment of electricity services from both municipalities and Soweto, which currently sits at around 40 billion rand. So if you think about this debt and the extent to which government has bailed out Eskom, it's almost like we put in money and the money goes straight out into municipal and Soweto non-payment. And the utility is currently not generating sufficient cash to cover its debt service obligations, and that the current tariff levels that have been approved have been less than what Eskom has asked for, which has driven the funding gap further. So in terms of the fiscal support that has been provided, there's 49 billion rand that has been made available for the current year, and for next year 56 billion, which is still going through the finalization of a special appropriation that would ensure that Eskom has 56 billion and to remain a going concern. So the CRO, as I've already said, is considering the debt options that government can explore in terms of dealing with Eskom's debt fundamentally, but that, as I have already said, will be subject to the Minister of Finance being satisfied that there is progress in terms of dealing with the fundamental operational and structural issues that Eskom is currently facing. In terms of the levers on the financial turnaround, I've already spoken about coal. You would recall that the Ministers of Public Enterprise and the Minister of Mineral Resources and Energy have already embarked on a process with the coal industry and coal suppliers to renegotiate some of the coal contracts that we deem as onerous on Eskom, and to ensure that everybody contributes to a solution around finding a fundamental solution, which primarily is not about Eskom, but ensuring that we've got a viable Eskom that can support the South African economy. The second one is around the IPPs, and the two ministers have already had initial conversation with the IPPs primarily from the first three round around renegotiating the base price from which this IPPs have been signed. The third issue is around the disposal of non-core asset. Eskom has been given until March next year to ensure that they realize the sale of Eskom Finance Company, which is a loan book that Eskom has, in order for them to contribute to the cash requirements that the business has. In terms of employee benefits, you'd recall that the President and the Minister have made a commitment that there will be no retrenchment. Eskom has been requested to look at alternatives which would include natural attrition and early retirements, but obviously these must be balanced against retaining critical skills in the business, and this must also still be negotiated and consulted with labour. Eskom has also been given a task to ensure that they collect all revenue, and government has committed to starting a campaign to ensure that the culture of non-payment in the country is confronted, because this is not just a problem for Eskom, it's a problem for e-tolling, it's a problem for water boards. They face similar issues in terms of non-payment of services. The next point is around on tariff decisions. I think we have seen a lot of uncertainty in terms of how Eskom and NERSA have conducted their affairs. Firstly, the interpretation of the regulatory methodology has always resulted in the gap between the two parties, which is a big concern for us, and I think it will be a big concern for investors, because it therefore means we are not able to predict fairly closely regulatory decisions. And we are in conversation with the Minister of Energy in terms of finalizing the NERSA Amendment Bill, which would provide for the establishment of a tribunal where NERSA decisions can be taken to by Eskom without going through a court process, because we don't believe that the court process, one, is expedient enough to provide quick decisions that are required by Eskom, but secondly, we also do not believe that the court is a competent body to adjudicate matters around the regulatory methodology. So we need a tribunal that has regulatory experts that can assist this process. As I've already alluded to, in terms of the just transition, so I won't spend a lot of time on this slide, but there is a commitment from government. Firstly, there's a presidential working group at NEDLAC where the conversations around jobs and the just transition in terms of ensuring that in the decommissioning of plants, employees and communities where these power plants are currently operating are provided with alternatives and consideration around alternative economic activities that can be introduced in those localities to ensure that there is an orderly wind down of these plants when the time does arrive, which is inevitable, and that we are working with other social partners to ensure that we do have specific plans per power plant to ensure that the process is managed effectively. In terms of the execution of the reforms of Eskom, we do expect that Eskom will have a restructuring office and team which will drive this process on an ongoing basis. There will also be an establishment of a government monitoring office housed within the DPE that will include various government departments and experts. And the function of this team will not only to be to monitor, but there's a lot of policy issues that will need to be ironed out within government, and we expect that this team will work as a clearinghouse for those issues that need to be sorted out with a number of departments where there are cross-cutting issues that must be addressed. Parliament will be appraised on an ongoing basis in terms of progress with this process. The same with cabinet, who will provide monthly reports, and we expect that Eskom will be producing specific reports on a quarterly basis related to their unbundling process. So, in summary, I think I want to emphasize that there are a number of challenges that Eskom is facing, and that the unbundling is not a silver bullet in terms of all the problems that Eskom faces. So there are a number of interventions to deal with these challenges, and the restructuring of Eskom is one of the interventions. But the interventions include a generation recovery plan, the radical reduction of cost, explicit government support in terms of ESCOM's debt burden. We need to resolve the non-payment culture. We need to deal with the environmental compliance issues and the implementation of the IRP, and then we also need to deal with issues around the just transition to ensure that stakeholders or employees and local communities are protected in the decommissioning process. I think it is an important fact to emphasize, because often I think maybe our story comes across as we are saying unbundling will resolve all of ESCOM's issues or the restructuring. There are a number of interventions that are being implemented to ensure that the multitude of challenges that ESCOM currently faces are resolved. In conclusion, Chair, to recap, is that ESCOM will be separated into three different entities. There is a prioritization in terms of establishing the transmission entities. The coal will remain in the fleet for a considerable period of time, a minimum of 50 years if you use Kusile as a base, and longer if you look at the coal IPP. So the country will still rely on coal for electricity generation for a considerable period of time, and that ESCOM's debt and poor financial state is a major threat to our fiscal position as a country, and that government remains committed to a pro-poor just transition process, particularly minimizing impact on workers and communities while complying with the minimum emission standard. Chair, that's all for me.
Thank you, DDG. Honourable members, that is the briefing on ESCOM special paper, and we will expect honourable members to start engaging. Honourable Mkwanasi, I see your hand, followed by. Let me just go through this way, Honourable Members, because your hands are all coming. Yeah.
Thanks, Chair. We appreciate the presentation as much as it was going to be nice to get it from the executive, but we really appreciate the presentation. Honourable Chairperson, just for first, I'm really interested, Honourable Chair, to understand and to get the views of the Cabinet and to the paper. Do they have the views? Do they discuss and see the paper? What are the views? I'm asking that, Chair, because of the cross-cutting issues when we are dealing with ESCOM. But I'm asking that because I think we must not lose focus in understanding that the main purpose of the state-owned companies is to operationalize the broad social economic development plans for the whole government, and to and generate inclusive growth for the government, to provide efficient network services to those who can pay and those who cannot pay. So I think based on that, I just want to understand the views. But Chair, on page 2 of the presentation, on page on page 3 of the presentation, I just want to be taken into confidence about the process and the program ESCOM has currently on their asset management a problem. Do they have the plan to improve on that field? What are the plans in action? What are the plans currently, and what are the plans in the future? Fourthly, Chair, the relevance of ESCOM finance, but I'm partially covered about the presentation. I think in slide in the progress to say you're dealing with the non-co functions, but I'm worried, Chair, and you always the issue of the time frames and the implementation within the time frames. To say, looking at your processes, you'll be able to deliver that within the time frame, because you said the time frame is within March, it must be before March 2020, if I had it correct. But are you able to deliver on that? I'm asking that, Honorable Chair, based on the issue that was raised on bullet... on bullet 4, yes, and on bullet 8, on the issue of making sure that we minimize the spending vis-a-vis the issue of Eskom able to be able to sustain itself. Chair, I think I will. My last two questions. I will really want to be taking into confidence on page 13 of the presentation of the DDG on the issue of consultation and the issue of legislation review, the processes and the time frames. If we need to consult, what are the processes going forward? Who are we consulting, and what legislations are we talking about, and what is the role of this portfolio committee in particular, and what is the role of local general of parliament, but also the issue of private players vis-a-vis the issue of privatization. I think we need to be, Chair, we need to be taken into confidence about it, and also to be taken fairly on the issues of saying what is it that is going to happen when we involve the private players, as you said in the presentation. For now, Chair, I think I will end there. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. May I join my colleague in terms of thanking the comprehensive report? It's very detailed, and I hope it will address many of the concerns that we have, not as politicians, as well as the communities outside. But my understanding is we are in this dilemma because of one thing that many of us have failed to confront, and that is corruption. It's good that we configure and change our form and come into the next format. What steps has the department taken to ensure that we are not sailing along with some of those rotten potatoes which may still be remained perhaps within the system? The second question is, as we usher into the new phase, I know that in many instances we all say that municipalities are weak, municipalities don't have money. Are we not going to face a similar situation where many of the municipalities, as much as I understand the CRO that the minister has set up, do we have a strategy that in fact will monitor the municipalities that they do pay, so that in the near future we are not seen being crippled again by the non-payment of the municipalities? I want to say our coexistence at times is very, very much political. Therefore, I will urge, as much as I don't know how the department will address this, that some of the concerns that are raised by unions, it may create some distortions, but if they are not addressed vigorously, they may at times derail us or even influence the communities outside. There is one thing critical that I will urge that the department do. I'm hoping that the department is exposed to the social media. So my understanding is as well that we need to take the masses along with us. I'm happy with what my colleague has raised, that it will be good as well to get the views from the cabinet, if ever there are any, that what's the concern, so that we all move in unison. May I stop here, because some of the questions that I've jotted have been addressed. If ever there is a need, I'll come back.
Thank you. Honorable Kumed, can you switch your mic on? Honorable Shabala.
Thanks, Chairperson. Wanted the minister, but we understand that minister is at cabinet, to pose questions. So I'll try to be mild. You know, it's a shame you're alone. I feel for you. I don't even know where to begin. So let me try to be as mild as I can, and start by welcoming the paper. We saw it when minister was making media briefing on it. Look, it's much welcomed at this point, because we want power generation at this point, we want stability, but we want to move ahead from the issues that we've been hanging around Eskom and its financial state at this point. So for me, at this point, and I would like to say as the ANC, we're really looking forward to this unbundling. However, there are concerns, so I'll just be mild and trying for you. One, can I just ask that, what are the driving forces behind this roadmap? The roadmap, the bureaucrats that came up with the roadmap, because I would like to think you didn't sit down and write it. So I'm sure there should have been certain skills or other bureaucrats or persons that we consulted insofar as coming up with this roadmap. I'm kind of interested to get the masterpiece around this, so that we understand the backdrop of the peoples who are coming with us. The board appointment, it says somewhere in your presentations that the board by the 31st of December, the current board of Eskom is not complete. It needs to be completed by this the next month. So I want to find out how far is that process. I link my question to the issue of the boards. Is that in these three phases and these three unbundling, will there be boards appointed to all these three unbundling? And at what cost do they come with all these boards? And what process, again, the timelines of making sure that they will be in place, considering the fact that we're saying by March you should be in place. So I just wonder, at what cost to the state will this board appointment, and will it really take the whole full composition of the board, or there will be specific persons designated for specific matters that they must look into, considering the fact that time, we don't have luxury of time, especially with the issues of Eskom. I know my minister is never afraid to ask to answer difficult questions. The NUMSA and NUM outlined its position around against the separation. Is that the case? And the fact that there is fears around the loss of jobs, it's not a secret. That of course it will exacerbate the rate of unemployment and foster the low economic growth. Has the department itself discussed with all the stakeholders in finding some amicable solution, but also finding each other insofar so that we can move forward and we can be able to bring some confidence around the issue of job losses? What are we going to do around that? The discussions with co-producers, it says in your roadmap you're going to consider indexing the price of coal supplied to Eskom in an attempt to contain price inflation. What is the view of the department insofar as the energy Department of Energy and Minerals, and how will this affect the coal mining industry? The markets, you just said the market, markets are looking for policy certainty more than anything else, and you're saying that it kind of like there isn't a view necessarily. I mean, it's a wait and see what's going to come, but what will we say to markets insofar as policy certainty on this issue? The non-core assets, do we have strategic partners, and who are we selling these non-core assets to? I mean, you're talking about, of course, the loan book, it's not looking good, but if we're going to sell and get rid of the non-core assets, is it going to come at more, are we going to generate some revenue? It's a burden that we're getting rid of, but is it going to give us some sort of a revenue? The last point, the municipality debt, it's here on your presentation. You know, the Soweto issue, and I'm going to keep on raising this issue as far as Eskom comes before us, and as long as we keep on raising the 40 billion that we're saying we're not collecting in Soweto, and every month we're going to raise it almost as if it's a slogan. It's not a slogan. The issue of Soweto, reality of the situation that we live in an unequal society, and the people of Soweto, those are the despondent and indigent communities, and this is an historical issue. So the question I have for Eskom, and there's the proposals that we made, do we have a strategy, a way to engage? We agree with the president, people must pay for the electricity, people must pay for what they consume. But the president further goes that the people who can afford to pay. Now, have we done as Eskom and sat down with social development, because they will know the indigenous community, people who receive grants, they will know those states, that SA will know who are those communities, because you cannot switch off electricity for Soweto residents from the month of May. There are people who are sick. But the question that I have, those indigenous communities, you will know them. You will know people can afford to pay, who are employed, who are not paying for electricity. So the social grant, Department of Social Services, includes that SA can assist you. So you don't penalize somebody who's paying for over a person who's not paying, but you also don't penalize somebody who cannot afford to pay, who's unemployed, who's indigent, and we're living this situation, they're going to court, they're up in arms, but Eskom is not coming to the party. It is just saying people must just pay, and the 40 billion keeps on escalating. We are not resolving the situation, and my submission is that we need to change the attitude of our communities. It's time that we must educate our communities how they must have a good relationship with the power and with the electricity that they consume. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson.
I've got one question to ask, because Babu Kumete here covered me on a few questions that I wanted to ask. The presenter spoke about creating an intra-company competition and to ensure efficiency between different players. And she also mentioned that that has been the case before. So I want to understand as to why did Eskom do away with that in the first place.
Thank you, Honorable Lamed.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. It's promising. But now I think we miss about the strategy of the collection. I think next meeting maybe the Eskom must come with a very, very serious a strategy for collections, because there is a department also and the municipality, including the legal department, must be involved for these collections. It's not only Eskom only, because that is the money that lay there with that come in to the Eskom. Also, the the issue of this, the package of the salaries and package is not here in the roadmap, because also maybe the ESCOM got a huge package of the official, maybe all the monies that we are putting there is going to the, is not doing the right thing for the ESCOM because of the huge package. Also, issue of the coal. Where did you buy the coal? Because maybe the competition, the prices, maybe we can overlook also the coal system that we are buying the coal. Thank you, Chairperson. I must stop there because other things are covered.
Thank you, Chair. There are a couple of issues which I want to address. One is firstly to say that clearly we welcome the unbundling, and it's a positive move that needs to be applauded, and the timelines are in place, and this will have to be measured going forward in terms of that. Secondly, there are a couple of areas which I suppose I call park and pray areas. One is debt, where your EBIT is lower than what's required to service your debt, that needs clear addressing, and it would be very important for us as a committee, I think, to see the key measures from people who are much cleverer than me, who deal with finance, as to how they are going to address this particular issue. And it does impact on operational aspects, because the improvement of operational issues will then impact how you service your debt. The other area is labor and the bloated labor force that insofar as it exists. There our hands are tied, and I would again hope that we will address flexibility in this regard. The other is competition, corruption. I'd like as well to see a detailed exposition of the measures that are in place to deal with this. But that said, in terms of park and pray, there are a couple of areas that we can actually roll our sleeves up and address. One is good business practices, and we all pay lip service to the reduction of red tape and good business practices. They impact areas like procurement. For example, it's my understanding, and I'm new in this committee, but that there are two tiers of accreditation that's required for suppliers at an entity level and at overarching level. Now, why these two areas? Surely we can deal with this in a more intelligent fashion. If you take the issue of coal, so when you see emergency trucks going out, you understand that there are coal shortages. I have no doubt that management is able to count. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that we'll run out of coal at this particular time if we don't have. But the point is that what we have in terms of, don't have in terms of good business practices perhaps, is that what's in place requires you to go out to tender. That takes 3 months in terms of processes. You need so many tenders. In the meanwhile, there's a gap where you have shortages and you can't address this. Now, if you can't address that structural problem, then you're just going to be doing the same things and saying, we'll try and work on this. It doesn't particularly help. So is anything being done about this is my question. The other area is HR. It seems to me there's a kind of one-size-fits-all approach. People's performance in a business are impacted by how others perform. So you can't have a one-size-fits-all process. So the question is, do we have a system of differentiated incentives by business unit? I think that will be useful to assist people to do their jobs better, because fairness, after all, means that everyone needs to be measured by their performance. That's fairness as far as I can see. Not everyone must be the same. Now, the overarching issue that comes to mind that impacts all of this for me is
The interpretation of government shareholder directives, and I wish the minister was here, to management and to the entity. The government shareholder representatives are there on a daily basis, often engaging, perhaps telling management what they should do. It is my understanding, and I pose this as a question, does this not in some way in the past, and we continue to do in the future, create a kind of climate of fear perhaps, and of over stringent application of PFMI measures, for example? We need to build a culture of trust between the shareholder and employees, and transparency is terribly important. Now, in terms of transparency, I don't know how I'm going to do my job on this committee if I don't have sight of the shareholder compact. That is a crucial document which I and this committee needs to see. And I looked for it left, right, and center, but I don't find it. So perhaps you can assist me in this regard. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mara.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to first make a remark about the one slide that Eskom's current financial position on point, on those bullet points, where the coal costs have increased fivefold and the payroll costs threefold over the past decade, and about the outstanding fees are in excess of 40 billion. And that together with a loss of management and engineering skills, although there's this increase in cost as far as staff cost, to put it that way. Now, when we actually will unbundle, to put it that way, how would this whole situation be cut cost-wise between the three entities, to put it in that line? And a crucial question would be, if Eskom remained the owner of the transmission entity, there will not be a fair competition between the IPPs and Eskom generation. How is that going to work? That's going to be an unfair situation going forward. And another question is, what is the possibilities now here going forward as we actually now to engage in solving this problem? What possibilities are there for public-private partnerships going forward, and to increase the public-private partnership or even privatization of some of these functions going forward? And a very, very important issue is this generation of electricity, and more than 90% of it's dependent on coal. And I think there must be a very serious look at the contracts of all the coal mines. And it should be a long-term contract that must be put in place, and as previously has been done. And it was to the benefit of Eskom years ago. We can go back in the history and we can look at it. And it did work very well. Now, new energy going forward. And clean energy, we know, that is the thing of the new millennium. And how is the government going to actually boost that section of the energy mix going forward as part of the bigger mix? Because we know at this point in time that that portion is so small versus the portion of coal-driven energy. And then this question about the closure of power stations, the old ones, and then the question about the new ones, Kusile and Matupi, that's been built. And that is very strange. How is it possible that two brand new power stations default time on time with problems? So what happened with when it was newly built and it is still in process? There was people in charge of this multi-billion projects. that we experience the quality of work that is not up to standard, what is being delivered. Because we shouldn't experience these problems with newly built power stations. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Let me welcome the presentation as I join my colleagues. And I don't have much. Most issues have been raised, and even to say the minister is not here, it was going to be fair enough for us to also get the responses or some of the clarities from the minister. But let me just have two questions. Apparently, acting DDG, there's a, in terms of NARSA, there's a tariff determination that has been challenged to the financial situation of Eskom. So my question would be to say, how are you handling it internally as department, as an advisor or as the overseer of Eskom? And secondly, my question will be on the issue of stakeholder engagement, in a sense that the document is of high level. And when talking about Eskom, it's for a public, it's for the public interest. South Africans at large wants to understand actually what does this on a daily or on an ABC language for them, what this unbundling is. Then in terms of your plan, how are you going to engage stakeholders into this and explain or deliberate it further for even a mere just community member to understand? One, if you don't understand it, or our community members might think the minute you present this document, it means there will be no load shedding anymore. But I believe it's not the right way. So how do we put our communities into confidence to understand versus this roadmap versus the load shedding? Do you have a proper plan in place? And not forgetting the major stakeholder, which is your municipalities, that they are the ones who gives, who receives, and their communities as the end user of the energy or Eskom product. So what is more important to me, it's, I really want to understand what is your plan in place to engage, especially with ordinary South Africans, to understand this roadmap and this process, because it's a high-level thing. But then do we have a plan to communicate with our communities? Unnecessary protest, unnecessary conflict within municipalities, Eskom, and the department itself. How are you going to consult? Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, honorable members. Thank you, honorable Perry. DDG, I think you're here to handle all the issues in relation to the content of this document. I think that's what is important. If there is any question that you have been brought here to handle this question by the minister, because he appreciates your capacity to deal with the situation. I'm only having one question, that is, in the light of the three envisaged subsidiaries, let's say 2021, we have been finally unbundled Eskom. Will Eskom wither away, or will we have some kind of a coordinating structure or governance or any form of something that will be referred to as Eskom, or we won't have anything? We'll be dealing with an entity which is called, which is dealing with transmission, and it will have its own name, if there will be a name, or generation. We won't have the phrase called Eskom in our lips will end. I just have that, or perhaps we'll be having what Honorable Chavala was asking. We'll be having these three entities with their own boards and the executive. If it will be a picture in that. Thank you. I think you are now ready. Now, take us through. If your minister come, you still have time, we'll give him to assist you.
I will hand over immediately.
No. You capture the question. You want to that.
I'll assist you with questions.
Yeah. That's why I was having a problem with people who are referring to the minister who is not here. If the minister was here, I didn't know. The minister is not here, you are here on his behalf. That's the end of the questions.
Okay. Thank you, members, for the questions. I'll try and answer as detailed each question as possible. The question of Cabinet's view on the paper, so the paper was presented to Cabinet before it was released, and it was endorsed by Cabinet. I think a lot of the cross-cutting issues were also identified, and hence I referred to a structure within government which will be a clearinghouse in terms of dealing with the cross-cutting issues, including the environmental issues, which we are dealing with the environmental affairs, the just transition, impact on communities, policy issues in relation to the Department of Mineral Resources. So it does enjoy Cabinet's decision, and I think the cross-cutting issues have been identified. In terms of the question around impact on the poor has come across consistently, also related to the question on Soweto and whether we have a good view of the impact on indigents in terms of Eskom electricity. So in terms of the poor policies in relation to electricity, government does have a free basic electricity policy, which requires that each municipality or each entity that provides electricity in an area does have an indigent register. In the indigent register, we provide for a minimum of 50 kilowatt hours per month for free for poor households, and there are municipalities that actually do budget over and above the 50 kilowatt hours. Itsekwini is actually has done quite well in terms of implementing the FBE. I think the challenges we have had is municipalities' ability to identify indigents, ensure that the registers are up to date, and to also ensure that the free basic electricity is only provided to households that deserve to receive the free basic electricity. So the policy is in place that is meant to protect the poor, but there is challenges in terms of ensuring that municipalities ensure that the monies get to the right place. So in relation to Soweto, I don't think that this is the primary issue, but perhaps Eskom itself needs to be able to provide a picture in terms of have they been able to successfully identify the indigent list and ensuring that those households do get the free basic electricity that has been provided for. I think it's an action that we can follow to ensure that it does support the point of ensuring that we do pursue the right people that do have money, but that are just not paying. I think it's important to mention that even government departments do owe municipalities money. So more often it's not about affordability, but it's about the discipline of paying for services that have been rendered. The question around asset management now, in terms of how the plants are being maintained. Yes, Eskom does have asset management principles. These are the same asset management principles that Eskom has been using when the plants were performing well. So there clearly is an issue around disciplined execution and ensuring that the asset management principles are executed, but to also ensure that how the board and Exco manage the risk in relation to shortages of resources in the business, that the limited resources are spent in areas that are most impactful in the business. So there is an issue around Eskom not having sufficient money to spend on all the things that they want to do, but there has to be a rationalization about in managing the risks of the business. CAPEX must be spent in areas that are most impactful, and we are having conversations around the extent to which Eskom can afford the plans that it currently has. In terms of the ESC disposal, we currently, because of the extent of challenges that Eskom has, we have got weekly meetings where we discuss their liquidity position to ensure that they've got sufficient cash in the business, but that they're also dealing with the cost side of things. So from an ESC perspective, it's a specific item that we do monitor. ESC is actually a very good loan book, because it has employees on there that are guaranteed income every month. So from a Mama Care perspective, it's a good loan book. So we're not discarding it because it's a distressed asset. It's a good loan book, and we expect to get quite good value for it from the market. In terms of a question on slide 13 about the legislative and consultative process, there's various stakeholders that have been consulted at the development of the paper. This included, you'll recall that this initial decision came from SONA, the President SONA speech in February. In February this year, and that post that there has been a number of consultation with stakeholders, including meetings that the President himself held with labor formations, including meetings that the Minister has had with various unions and labor federations, and ESCOM level meetings that the board and management have held with unions in terms of consultation on issues. I think the issue around job security and concerns around job security is understood. And we are constantly reaffirming the position that in this process there will be no large-scale retrenchments in terms of Section 189 of Eskom employees, but that we will explore alternatives because we have to deal with the issue of the manpower costs that Eskom has, but we will consider alternatives. I think the issue of dealing with Eskom must be understood in relation, like I said earlier, in relation to the economy. So preserving jobs within Eskom does not assist us to preserve jobs in the bigger economy, in the sense that if we don't resolve Eskom in terms of certainty of electricity supply and trying to get efficient cost, then we will continue to see the extent to which we are seeing factories and large customers closing their shops in South Africa. So we need to ensure that, you know, we are able to articulate the story well, that resolving Eskom is important to resolving the bigger economic question that we have in the country. So as much as there's a commitment not to do large-scale retrenchments, there has to be a process in terms of dealing with the fundamentals around the cost base, so that we've got an entity that can support and enable economic growth in the country. The question around the private players versus privatization. So in the current plan, in terms of how it's articulated, there is no decision around privatizing any aspect of the Eskom business as we have, save for the non-core assets that were raised earlier on that will be disposed. But we will see more private players come into the generation sector as we expand the generation capacity that's required. So as you decommission the plants, you will see more IPPs come in to build different types of technology, whether it's renewables, there's coal IPPs that I've already announced, and there's also, I guess, master plan that the Department of Minerals and Energy is currently working on. So there is no privatization, but certainly an increase in private sector participation in the sector is what we anticipate. Honorable Gumede says, asking, are we here because of corruption? I think the ESCOM crisis is a result of a protected period of bad decisions that we have made, bad firstly as government and secondly as ESCOM management in itself. So government, from a government perspective, in the sense that we made a decision around building this plant too late. We built it off tariffs, and that we've had significant cost overruns and schedule overruns that have added onto ESCOM's debt burden, firstly. Secondly, that has resulted in ESCOM spending the majority of its capex on the new build instead of maintaining existing plant. I think corruption and the extent of corruption that we've seen in the last few years was an added factor in terms of worsening the situation at ESCOM, but primarily it's because of the bad business decisions that we've made, and also bad policy decisions we've made in terms of deciding too late to build this power plant. And maybe to just conclude with Honorable Maria's question around why the plants are performing in this way, is because we went to market with this plant with very conceptual designs. We didn't have detailed designs about what we were procuring from market, and we made a lot of bad design choices, and that also the execution and the decision for ESCOM to integrate by itself the size of this project also, you know, contributed to the extent to which we have had challenges with this project. So it's design errors. It's lack of detailed design when you contract, and also bad contracting in terms of liability from both parties in how the whole project was structured. I think we've learned a lot from a department's perspective. We've done independent studies. I think there's a lot of lessons learned for government in terms of how to not do large infrastructure project, and then I think over and above that, we decided on large plans because of the extent of the gap that we are anticipating in the system, instead of maybe considering smaller projects. But we ended up with a concentration of risk and large plans that we couldn't execute on time and or to the right quality and standard. Do we have a strategy to monitor the municipal debt? Yes. Like I said, the Minister of COCTA chairs an IMTT that looks at issues around municipal debt, looking at the policy gaps that need to be identified. But we have not seen a reduction in terms of the rate at which the municipal debt is growing. If anything, the rate at which municipal debt is growing is increasing at about 1.5 billion now per month. And this is of huge concern. ESCOM has established an additional team that looks at dealing with specific municipalities, those that are not paying, but also those that are paying, to ensure that they do continue to pay. I think you would have seen a number of court actions across the country in terms of either ESCOM getting into agreement with customers directly that are within municipal environment so that they get paid directly, or trying to interrupt municipalities in terms against non-payment of legacy debt. So this is an issue, this is an area where we have not had a lot of traction in terms of dealing with the problem, but there is a number of platforms that are currently dealing with the municipal and Soweto debt. I think the union's concerns, could they potentially derail this process? There is ongoing engagements that we are having with labor. I think that there are concerns that we have noted. There's an ESCOM leadership task team that we have established at NETLEC, where we are engaging with civil society, business and labor in terms of the concerns that are raised. I think, you know, we don't expect that this is going to be an easy journey, but we do continue to engage, hoping that we can have productive conversations with labor that would ensure that the totality of the system and the totality of South Africa is better off in how we deal with the ESCOM problem comprehensively. So what are the driving forces behind coming with the paper? So maybe just to go back to where the decision came from. So if you recall, in November last year, the board had submitted a turnaround plan to government, and in that plan they had asked government for about 100 billion rand bailout, and they were proposing large cost saving within the business, which included the retrenchments that I alluded to earlier on, and certain levels of tariff they had applied for from NERSA in terms of the multi-year price determination. The president then had made the decision around getting an independent view on what ESCOM was asking for, because a further 100 billion rand bailout for ESCOM is quite significant, and I think if you look at the country's fiscal position, you will see the constraints that government currently have in terms of our ability to bail out not just ESCOM but other entities, and to also look at the larger programs of government and the large amounts of money that are currently required. So he decided to have an independent task team that would look at whether this is a fundamental solution that is being presented by the board, and what other policy issues would be considered. And one of the recommendations that was made out of that was that we must commence on a restructuring process with ESCOM. But going back to the policy framework in the country, is that in 1998, the Minister of Energy at the time had released a white paper that actually lays the foundation of all the things that we are discussing here today. So this is not out of kilter with policy, and that's why Honorable Mukwanazi, we're not necessarily talking about large amendments to a lot of legislation in the sector, because the sector, the legislation as we currently have it, anticipated that the sector would evolve in this fashion. So the white paper on energy had already pronounced on the need to unbundle ESCOM, to restructure the sector. You would recall that in the 2000s there was an intense process around trying to establish the EDI. So these were all pronouncements that had already been made. So the foundation of this paper is actually in legislation, which is in the white paper, the Electricity Regulation Act. It provides for all the functions that we are trying to have. So we have had a lot of, in terms of support, a lot of conversations in terms of the policy department and in ensuring that we can align between various parties to ensure that the paper and the restructuring process does respond to the policy framework as anticipated by the Minister of Energy, because we don't make policy. We actually respond to what the policy position is from the Minister of Mineral Resource and Energy. In terms of the board process, yes, we currently have three vacancies on the ESCOM board following some resignations last year. There is a process that we are following to fill in these vacancies. But I think we are also looking at, if you recall, when this board was appointed, they had a very specific mandate to go and look at the governance failures that were there within the business. So there was a very specific consideration in terms of the mixture of skills that were put into this board. But if you look at the problem statement as we have it now, we need a different set of skills on the board. So we are having also a view around reviewing the skills matrix that we currently have on the board, and looking at strengthening the board further with those skills that that are required. In terms of the subsidiaries themselves, obviously you need a legal entity to be in place for you to appoint the board. So we would be looking to appoint a smaller board for the transmission business to drive this process. In the long run, yes, there will be three independent boards for each one of the entities at a subsidiary level, but we do anticipate that the holding company will remain in place. So there will still be the main board. The positions of labor, I think I've already addressed that we do continue to engage and we hope that we can, you know, get into having constructive conversation around what government is trying to achieve. I think the fears of unions are understood in terms of really, are we genuine in saying that there will be no job losses in this process? And we would want to hear, you know, what assurances unions would want to have in order for them to support this process, because I think it's quite important that we are able to close that gap in terms of trust between us and unions, and ensuring that we can be partners on this journey and in ensuring that Eskom can remain viable and that Eskom can be enabling to the South African economy. In terms of the coal index, so the conversations we've had with the coal industry were with both the Ministers of Public Enterprise and the Minister of Mineral Resource, and the Minister of Trade, Investment and Competition was also in the same discussion. So the development of the coal index is being led by the Department of Mineral Resource and Energy, and the whole principle is around Eskom should be paying the same amount of money for a similar grade of coal that you get from different sources. Obviously, logistics can be a factor in terms of differences between the two, but Eskom should not be paying different prices for similar grade of coal, and I think we are on the same page with the Department of Mineral Resources in terms of an approach to that process. What has the market's response been on policy? I think a lot of the feedback we got from the market was, I think they expected fundamentally for us to have a debt solution in the paper, and I think they also expected that to be in the MTPBS, which we did not have. I think there was a lot of expectation that was building around that before we released both the paper and the MTPBS, but government had taken a view that we have bailed out Eskom a few times and we haven't really had the benefits of doing that. But if you go into Annex C in the MTPBS, there is acknowledgement that we have to do something. Government has to do something with the Eskom debt. So we don't expect that unbundling would somehow result in additional cash for Eskom that would be sufficient for them to cover their obligation. Government is going to have to step in to deal with that problem over and above the support that has already been announced. So we hope that the market, you know, can we have provided sufficient clarity now to the market for them to understand how we intend to embark on this journey and to provide clarity about the roadmap. So in terms of the non-core assets, I think we go out into the market with the assets that have been identified. So there isn't really specific partners that are identified upfront in terms of the disposal. It's a process that Eskom themselves are running. This is a disposal of an asset. So from a shareholder's perspective, we would anticipate that there would be a PFMA application that must then be approved for this process to be concluded. So if check, should I continue? Okay. So in terms of the question about the intra-company competition and why was it stopped? So when Eskom implemented what was supposed to be a center-led strategy around how the business is structured, which became a centralized strategy, so it became a lot more difficult, I think, for each side to have very specific costs that can be accounted for per side, because a lot of the functions became centralized. So for you to know what it costs to produce a unit of energy, you need to know all input costs, including manpower, whether it's finance, IT, and HR. And with a centralized strategy, it becomes a bit difficult for those costs to be allocated centrally. In terms of the request for us to bring a strategy around municipal debt, I think we are quite happy to ask Eskom to come to the committee and provide an update of where we are with dealing with the debt and whether the strategy is yielding results and what support would be required from the committee to do so. The question around coal and where do we get it, I think the one of the primary issues, which is what Honorable Shabalala was raising around policy, is that if you look at the coal sector in South Africa, over the last 10 years, we really have not had growth because we were producing 270 million tonnes per annum, of which Eskom consumes about 110 million tonnes, and we are still producing the same level of coal. And the extent to which Eskom-grade coal started being attractive to the export market also became an issue. So from Eskom being able to have a broader market to source coal from, their quite constraints, and I think that's one of the issues what makes it a bit difficult for them to be able to negotiate sound pricing for coal. But we do expect that we would get into the detailed conversation around renegotiating the existing contracts so that, you know, we have the benefits in terms of cost. I think that the question around debt, I think I have addressed. So we do recognize that we need to present a debt solution. But like I said, the government's position is that there must be a clear demonstration of progress with operational and restructuring so that we are not bailing out an entity that's going to stay the same. In terms of procurement, I think we do say in the paper that we recognize that procurement is an issue and that it is at the core of Eskom's issues and also related to the issues of deep corruption that we see in the business, and that there would be consideration around alternatives to the procurement strategy that we have. But I think there's also a question around the procurement framework that we have as a country, and that the National Treasury is embarking on a process to look at what are the policies that we currently have in place that are not enabling. But I think we must also recognize the spirit of the law and why the Treasury has embarked on the type of procurement framework that they have instituted in government and in government entities, which was to provide assurance around how public funds are spent. So as we question the enabling nature of that framework, I think we need to be able to recognize why it was put in the first place, and that we would need to, as we think about reforming that, we would need to think about whether a different system would give assurance about around how money is spent. I'm going to leave the question around government directive to my minister here. In terms of the shareholder compact, I think in last week's meeting, and I would have to consult with colleagues, the presentation from the department on its performance, the shareholder compact would have been included, but I think we are quite happy to provide that to members. There's no issue. In terms of Honorable Maria's question around how will costs be cut across the three entities, I think it's quite important to make the point that what we are not embarking on is a restructuring into three entities that are all not viable. And that's why we are executing all these levers in parallel. So it's important that you're able to deal with revenue, that you're dealing with costs, so that when you have the three separate entities, they are all sustainable on a standalone basis. Because if we just unbundle Eskom in its current form now, you will have three entities that are not viable. So the cost cutting and the revenue strengthening needs to be will precede the process of breaking Eskom up into the three subsidiaries, and we've already embarked on that process of identifying and dealing with the specific levers. What is the possibility of PPPs in the unbundled Eskom? I think I've already alluded to the expansion of generation, that it will primarily be from private sector, but in terms of the existing Eskom, there is currently no conversation around privatizing any one part or having private sector participation. But I think it's important to also say that we do have private sector participation at Eskom. There are functions within power plants, there are functions within distribution, if you look at meter reading and so forth. Some of those functions have been outsourced to private parties to execute. So as much as we say Eskom is a dominant player, there is a good extent to which there are a lot of contractors on site that are performing certain functions on behalf of Eskom. But I presume your question was around equity participation, so that equity participation, we are not discussing that for now. Coal mines to be looked at and contracted on a long-term basis. I think that has been one of the drivers, that Eskom has been contracting coal on a short-term basis, and also from mines that are at a distance to power plants, which has also driven contributed to the extent to which Eskom coal costs have grown. So as part of the Eskom's coal procurement strategy framework, they're looking at reinvesting in cost plus mines, which are tied collieries to the stations, which should provide a downward pressure on coal costs going forward. How will government support cleaner energy? I think we already have a procurement framework in terms of IPPs. The procurement framework is as you currently know it, which is driven by Minister of Energy issuing determinations for additional capacity that is required, and that is followed by a procurement process that is run by the IPP office. So that it will be the same framework that we will use to procure power going forward. Like I said, in the long run, when you've got an independent transmission company, we expect that the procurement function would then come into the transmission entity, which has a real-time view of capacity requirements, and that they will be in a position to make those decisions around procurement of additional power. The question, Honorable Piri, on the NERSA determination and impact on Eskom, yes, I think you are correct that if we just look at the recent MYPD4, there is a gap between what Eskom asked for and what was granted. The Eskom has gone to court to try and have a NERSA's decision overturned. I think the primary concern we also have as a shareholder is that the shareholder support that was provided to Eskom was also discounted in the regulatory decision. So they basically looked at it as other income and they reduced the return that was given to Eskom. So it is a concern to us whether NERSA would continue to treat the further government support that will be provided to Eskom in the same way, and we are having a conversation with the policy department whether there are legal instruments that would enable a more speedy resolution of this issue, because we don't think that the court process is really enabling in terms of ensuring that we can get a quick decision. So the court process could take a number of years. But secondly, if you look at historic decisions that the court has made, they've referred these matters back to NERSA to consider, because they don't deem themselves to be a competent body to make regulatory decisions. And hence I was saying that we are talking to the Department of Energy around ensuring that the NERSA Amendment Bill is finalized to ensure that there can be a tribunal where NERSA decisions can be taken for appeal. At the moment, there is no appeal body. The only recourse that Eskom would have or NERSA would have would be a court process. Okay, I'll leave also the last question to my minister.
Thank you, DDG. But I will ask, because we still have 30 minutes, honourable members, and I want us to use it, one, as question to the minister, or and follow up to a particular question. Or perhaps if you have a question that is not properly captured, you've got that opportunity. It's only 1 minute per member. I'll try to be very strict because there are outstanding questions that she has referred to the minister with what you'll be adding. Therefore, that 15 minutes of him responding, we must allocate to him. Therefore, I'll start with Chabalala. As normally, I go down.
I think Shepherdson is so generous. I thought he wouldn't give us a chance. Minister, we did welcome the paper. What was it is that it's long awaited for? At least we can see progress. I asked a question, I think Ms. Mokola didn't answer it, about the driving forces. How did we come to this document? Is it bureaucrats? Is it external partners that really came up with this brilliant white paper, for us to just understand the bureaucracy, or rather the good minds that came up with this paper. The corruption remains an issue, and it's mentioned. Page, and thanks, Chairperson, 29. This recovery proceeds, you know, we've been rehearsing this thing of state of capture and so forth and so on, but the underlying fact is that the issue of the vetting remains a primary issue. So declarations of interest, security clearances, how are we going to ensure this is done from the onset, including the board members that must be vetters, must have security clearance, so that we don't even go with these three phases, we end up with the same bureaucrats, the same people in the supply chain, procurement process, people who are intelligent enough to overcloud and cloud the processes. So I'm really concerned about it. It's been coming in scope. How are we dealing with it? Chair, let me leave it there. Thank you.
Room Konazi.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks again for the second round. I just want to make a follow-up on the issue raised by myself and Honorable Piri on the issue of consultation. Just to be detailed, I think Honorable Pelle tried to cover it in the very detailed issue to say what is it that will do to inform the person down there, the consumer or the customer, to say on the process, and what would be the benefits of us as government and also the consumer, because we must bear in mind that we are doing this based on the mandate of the state-owned companies by the government. Secondly, Chair, I'm really want this to be answered by the the minister. I am now addressing you. Sorry for that. On your presentation, slide 17, on the sixth. Major benefits, the second benefit and the last benefit drives economic growth in the country, if I can be taken to the how part of it, and to promote innovation and entrepreneurship, can I be taken through the how part of it? That should be my take, Chair. Thank you.
Honorable Mkwanazi, Honorable Gumede.
Chair, perhaps it will be, I think, very much fair that in the presence of the minister we say that we have been satisfied with the presentation and as well as the articulation of your answers. I think on my side, I think all other members are happy, but the chair will still cover that. But my question is just, it's a follow-up. It appears that when you were answering my question on corruption, you have, in fact, what's the term? You have made corruption secondary, right? But what, in fact, my thrust was more on some elements that may still be within the system, that we may be sailing along with them into the new era. The fear of unknown, that they may as well corrupt the system, right? So that was that perhaps it was going to make sense if we look into that. If there are none, anyway, we'll be happy, but if there are people that you may sort of be suspecting, what's a strategy? You know, I've heard one of the municipality that they've identified all those officials that were involved in a kind of corruption, and they've given them leave. Said, no, go on leave before, because we are now going for local government election, we may begin to tamper with the processes. I'm not sure, but anyway, that's where my thrust was, that what are we going to do with those people? The other one, that I've asked, it's in fact was mainly on communication. What is our communication strategy in terms of communicating all this as members of the committee? Some of us were still confused with all what is taking place, worse with the communities outside. Some of them don't even understand what exactly do we mean by load shedding. Now it's getting much more difficult now when we talk about unbundling. Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I'm sorry, Jay. But anyway, I'm covered.
Thank you, His Excellent Prince Buthelezi.
Yeah, you said I don't have a follow up. Thank you so much. Very progressive.
Yeah, that's progressive. Honorable Dabiri.
Thank you, Chair. Minister, since this term of the 6th, do you think that the situation of ESCOM is in this situation? Do you think that if you work together with the Minister of Energy, the situation was not in this in a situation, do you think that is it the good thing that work together, take the decision together instead of the coal and the all the problem of ESCOM?
Thank you, Honorable Lamini. Honorable Katalia.
Thank you, Chair. I welcome the replies on procurement and welcome the accession to the release of the shareholder compact. That's very welcome. And I note the address, the measures that have been put forward to address debt service, which are strongly aligned to operational improvement. But there was no reference to my question on HR and the one-size-fits-all approach in that. My question is, does ESCOM have a differential incentive program by business unit, because I think this is important for performance? And secondly, in terms of labor, you state that there's no large job losses envisaged, and at the same time say that you will have to deal with manpower, with the rising manpower costs. And there appears to be a contradiction here, and perhaps you'll address this. And I take it the Minister will address the other issue that I raised. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Kachalia. Honorable Mare, my homeboy.
No, I'm not going to ask further questions. I just want to know if the Minister if he's surviving all this SLV disease.
Okay.
I just want to know if the Minister is surviving all these problems with the SOCs.
Okay, Honorable Piri.
Thanks, Chair. As your minister, as the DDG has already given you my last question, and Honorable Mkwanazi has emphasized it is of interest to me and ordinary South Africans. But let me not repeat it and go to, there are 5 key challenges that are who have been presented that are happening in ESCOM. And it's one of those are in terms of governance and management that is failing. As much as the other colleague has raised it, and lack of accountability, further, as you have identified those, and as a shareholder, how are you going to make it a point that you do away with the fail of accountability? What are your processes in place versus even in the department itself, you still have acting DDG, acting DG. And we welcome also the appointment of the new CEO of ESCOM. But still, while you are busy planning and preparing and you have acting people who are on top there, then tomorrow
you're going to give new, because we can't dictate to you to say there must be those or whoever, but there are possibilities that you can employ a new person who must start to get to the run, who must understand all these processes. But then my plea to you is that can't you speed up this process, because they are the ones who are overseeing all this process, and let's get everybody on board when we start to say we are dealing with this paper. That is, I need to understand, are you getting it really, that having acting is something else? And also to concur with Honorable Kacha, the shareholders compact, how far? Because we have been told that it went to the cabinet. How far with it? If not, then what are the stumbling blocks? Because some of us, we believe, we might not have the proper answers or proper understanding. We believe it will also try to assist other state entities, even though it might not be ESCOM, but all those state entities has got the same. It will give us a better resolution on other issues. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Piri. Thank you, Honorable Members. You are very disciplined. Welcome, Minister, officially. I think I didn't properly welcome you. And we also appreciate that you stick to your plans in relation to the appointment of the CEO. We were worried that you might not make that commitment of 3 months that we were given. We really appreciate that. But also, DDG, Honorable Kalsharia, that question he was asking about the shareholder government representative, he was asking whether they are interacting, what form of interaction are they based there in an entity so that they can be engaged on daily basis. I don't know whether I captured. If I didn't capture you well, can you rephrase your government directive kind of question?
Chair, it was simply a comment and a question perhaps in relation to the nature of the involvement and engagement of the shareholders' representatives in ESCOM, the particular entity, and how they interacted in a manner that builds trust rather than creating a climate of sort of retribution and fear amongst people, because I think companies thrive on trust, and that needs to be built. That was the point I was making.
You captured it now. Okay. We start with the minister or with you. Okay. Thanks, Minister.
Good afternoon, and thank you for your patience. I unfortunately couldn't leave cabinet earlier, so couldn't be here. But let me thank my colleague for very ably presenting the paper. Quite evidently. and thanks for the questions. How does the paper get drafted? Well, it went through about 30 drafts. And there weren't really too many experts involved. It took a lot of hard work, but it also involved contributions from the Treasury, contributions from the Minister of Energy, contributions from the Minister of Environment, contributions from the Minister of DTI and C, as it is called now, so that we get different dimensions of the paper together, and you'll see that they are discrete elements that each of them contribute. And they are perhaps a follow-up paper that might be something that we're looking at, which is what are the technological changes that are happening in the energy terrain. There are smart grids, there's different forms of generation, there's clean climate or clean coal or technology that's available. There's the application of artificial intelligence to detect problems on the generation side or transmission side. So as we did this paper, we ran into all of those developments that are occurring around the world, and that refers to the point around innovation as well. So
we'll see if we get the space by early next year, we'll have some kind of framework or paper which tells us what are all these technology changes, including different types of generation that seem to be occurring. And the one that would be relevant in our case is how solar panels on rooftops of all our communities can actually revolutionize supply of energy on the one hand, but also people could earn income once our grid is ready to receive excess energy. So we could, the prince could generate, let's say, 200 kilowatts of energy, but he only uses 100. The other 100 can be sold, and you can get an income from that. That's into the future, but it's something that actually can change the character in our communities quite seriously. There were a couple of questions on corruption. Our observations 18 months down the line, but as I think Honorable Lavini was pointing out, a couple of months into the sixth administration, is that state capture and corruption still has its tentacles in all of these entities. Because you change a board or you change a management team doesn't mean that you've eliminated corruption. Secondly, when corruption is allowed at the top, it becomes systemic at some level. So it becomes okay and acceptable to engage in certain types of behavior. The third is that corruption could also take the form of disruption. In other words, you could have, as you can see, leakages of confidential board documents. So somebody in an office around the board and the papers that the board deals with then decides I'm going to leak it to whatever entity it needs to be leaked to. And in that way, we create a lot of confusion in the marketplace. So you would have seen a lot of confusion about the new CEO and names being banted around, all of which were wrong. But anxiety on the part of people who need to know then creates difficulties. Vetting, I think it happens at the senior management level, but I think there's a backlog in the system as well. We encounter that in departments also. What we need an update, which I don't have, unless my colleague has it, is what happened to the lifestyle audits. I think many of those, about 1,200 people were found to be in Eskom, certainly doing business with Eskom through proxies in one form or another. In other words, I'm an Eskom employee, I create a company in my wife's name or cousin's name, and then I make sure that they get the contracts or tenders that are actually involved. And some of those have been acted upon. I think you need another round of action, but the key deterrent is going to be when the first of these sorts of people who've already stolen a billion or more rands from Eskom in one form or another are actually in court and actually in your orange uniforms. So the sooner prosecutions occur, that's the greatest deterrence. And a lot of this fight-back narratives that we see around us is about protecting either access to tenders on the one hand or the fear that people are going to actually end up in jail. And so, you know, disrupt the process as much as possible, and hopefully it actually helps. So the fight against corruption is going to be a long-standing one, and it's important that even from a parliamentary point of view, we take a strong stand in this particular regard. Yesterday I met the union and I said to them, one of the things that unions need to come to on board with is when there's a member of the union who's been distinctly guilty of corruption, don't come to their defense. In fact, join us in making sure that we eradicate corruption or disruption in any form. So I think all of us as a society, if we don't want corruption to become
And this is not about any particular political party, by the way. It's across party lines, it's across all sorts of institutional lines as well. So if we want a better society to be left to future generations, then we must start doing the right thing now, in a sense. The benefits to the citizen, Honorable Mkunazi asks, and I want to relate this to the cost structure of Eskom and the issue of tariffs. So we hear this language which says we want cost-reflective tariffs. But the question we don't ask is what cost? So you can have costs of R1 billion and then say my tariff must actually pay for that cost. But inside that cost is wastage, is inefficiency, is procurement deficiencies, and you're asking citizens and businesses that you want to be world-class and competitive to actually pay for that. So we've now begun the second round of work. The first round, the management and board did extremely well. But there's a second round that will start, hopefully soon. Intensive analysis has been taking place of new opportunities to actually cut costs in Eskom, which could mean that you can stabilize the rate at which tariffs are increasing. Because it's fine to say you want tariffs to be increased in order to pay Eskom so that it can have the right kind of financial picture. But at the same time, I think we owe it to our economy that we lower the cost of doing business. Right? And what's increasingly coming up in this kind of economic climate is where electricity tariffs, freight tariffs, port tariffs, water tariffs, are all being raised in different forms by different types of businesses as cost-raising factors, right, which then makes companies uncompetitive, both in the domestic market, but particularly in the export market as well. So you can see the relationship. If you have efficient institutions giving us cost-effective tariffs, then it has a positive impact on the economy as a whole, and that's going to be an important contributor to the kind of growth path that government has formulated, both in terms of, for example, releasing spectrum, the e-visas, the certainty we now have on the energy front in terms of the integrated resource plan, and so on and so on. So there's a whole menu of things that we're doing right. This will be another supportive measure as far as the economy is concerned. And as you know, energy costs play a crucial role in different types of sectors of the economy, particularly manufacturing and mining get impacted by that. So that's a benefit, I think, ultimately that citizens will have. So I think the obligation government has is to have utilities that are structured in a way in which they are in line with the changes that are happening in the world, the changes that are happening in that particular sector. So if you take our ports in South Africa, there's 7, let's call them commercial ports. There was one stage at which our hometown, Durban, was the leading port on the African continent. Its ranking currently is number 3, right? Port Said in Egypt and Tangiers, I think that's in Morocco, are now number 1 and 2. So, and I was at our port on Monday to look at what's going on there. So this refers to Mr. Marais' question as he walks in again. How do you manage all these entities, and somehow you've got to manage them? But it's a lesson for us that we don't live in a world where everything stands still and waits for South Africa to catch up. We're living in a competitive, fast-moving world. And if we fall asleep somewhere along the line, the world is not going to wait for us, and the rest of Africa is not going to wait for us either. So either we clean up our acts quickly, get efficiencies into our system, make quick decisions about what needs to be done, and have the kind of competency that we require to implement our decisions, or we'll begin to fall in the global rankings and competitiveness rankings as well. And what we've learned in the last couple of weeks about, say, our ports, for example, is that we have huge opportunities
if those ports run efficiently. And that's why all the stakeholders need to come to the party, whether you are labor or freight forwarders or whatever. So in the latter part of the day on Monday, I met about 30 or 40 of the freight forwarding and shipping fraternity in Durban and many others as well, so that we can get their buy-in. And they came in a very positive spirit as well. So the benefit, not to the citizen only, but to the economy more generally, which means citizens ultimately, I think is very self-evident. If we move in line with the IRP, if we restructure Eskom in the way we are proposing, if we get efficiencies on the generation side, both through competition and better operational management, if we are able to remove unnecessary and burdensome costs, and coal is certainly one of them. So there's a menu of things that we need to do, some of which has already been done, more of which actually needs to be done as we go forward. On the entrepreneurship front, I think we have many younger engineers and so on who either want to come and work at Eskom or are working at Eskom, but also many outside who have ideas. And the new front that's opening up that honorable members might need to become aware of is the whole terrain of battery storage or storage of energy. Right? So battery storage is one form, but I've met young black engineers who have formed a company and they have another form of it as well. So it's giving rise to innovative ideas. They're coupling themselves with foreign companies. Some are just generating ideas themselves. And you'll begin to see some of that appearing soon on the stage as we go forward as well. Communication around unbundling, it'll take place over time. So as these changes happen, we'll have to start working particularly with local communities where power stations are. And in the paper, you'll see that in the section on just transition, we talk about a pilot project. So you can talk about just transition as an idea, but there's a power station that might close in 2 or 3 years' time. What happens to workers in the community there? So we want to work with Eskom and other government departments and stakeholders and create a pilot project from which in the next year we can learn what does it mean to retrain workers, what does it mean to get a different kind of entrepreneurial activity in communities around there, what does it mean to install a wind farm or a solar panel installation, how do you use what appear to be disused facilities. So there are many ideas around the world that when a power station is closed down, you can there's alternate uses that you can put it to. So the pilots are one way of experimenting and learning, and it's only by doing it that we're going to learn what the just transition means in the context of the kind of changes we need to make in our situation. In Cabinet, we work as a team, Honorable Dlamini. So the Minister of Energy's task, on the one hand, is to give us the IRP, so that we have that as a plan. They also approve all sorts of initiatives. So, for example, the next round of renewable IPPs depends on when the Department of Energy initiates that. And they also manage some of the NERSA issues that my colleague referred to earlier on. As far as Honorable Kachalia is concerned, I'm not familiar with the incentive programs that we have at Eskom, so we'll have to get the information for you. And then on the labor issue, I think that the approach we're taking is one which says, Chair, that as much as possible, we don't want people out in the streets. So we need to start, and you've heard us say this publicly, and the President has said it as well, we want labor, business, government, and the communities to work together to find different ways of deploying people. So currently, for example, as a particular unit at a power station gets shut down, like I think in Komati, some of the workers are being transferred to Kusile as the Kusile units begin to develop. So there's internal transfers that are taking place. We also have vacancies on the generation side in power stations themselves that need to be filled with particular types of operational engineers, some of whom disappeared and the vacancies weren't filled. So a while ago the board gave consent for 200 positions to be created, some of whom could come from these older power stations. We also need to look at municipalities. More than half of our municipalities, although they have the constitutional mandate to reticulate, as the constitution says, electricity, don't have the technical capability to do so. So as we get more work done on the distribution side, you could take some of the expertise that you have in Eskom and utilize it in municipalities or such structures as this might appear on the stage as we go forward. And then if our economy grows, there are all sorts of new possibilities that we will look at as well. So this isn't the kind of market narrative which says, and this is related to the point around interference that you've heard in the public discourse. So if you say don't fire 16,000 people, and if you consider that to be interference, well, I'm sorry, we are going to interfere, because it matters whether you put 16,000 families into the street as far as the ANC is concerned. And but in this case, there hasn't been interference in that sense. I don't go and I'll tell an engineer which spanner to use. And I don't go to a plant and say, don't buy this coal, buy that coal. What we do is when there are crises, as they have been over the last year around limitations on the generation side, is have urgent meetings with management and board to A, ask what's going on, B, what solutions are you working on, C, what assurances can you give the country that there will be no load shedding if that's possible, and if there is, give adequate notice of what the load shedding is, and E, if there is load shedding, keep it as short as possible, because it's a very disruptive event that actually takes place. But more importantly, what's our plan to get out of this situation? And clearly, we've said this to you before, we still need a safety buffer of 2,000 to 3,000 megawatts, which then allows Eskom to take a whole plant out for 3 or 4 months and do the long-term maintenance that needs to be done. Because that is what was not done in the last, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years. And part of that process of cost saving as well that we want to start looking at is those who provide maintenance services or repair services when there's tube leaks and so on, are they doing the quality of work that's required and at a cost that is required? I think I might have given you this number before, but the board informed me of a claim in relation to, I think, the two new plants lodged by a particular company, which says, pay me 27 billion rands. And when that claim was interrogated by a set of financial experts that they had hired, eventually that 27 billion rands became 2.7 billion rands. Right? So that's the private sector we're talking about. And I think my colleague was trying to explain the role. You know, this word privatization is a very misleading one. When you build Kusile or Medupi, you think it's Eskom workers that are building it. It's construction firms that do the civil work. It's engineering firms that put up the boiler. It's other types of engineers that put in the conveyor belt. It's other contractors that dig up the coal mine to make coal available. That's all the private sector that is actually involved. And the private sector is the biggest beneficiary of the billions of rands that we spend and overspend in all of these projects at the end of the day. So I think we must get our conception right, not worry too much about ideology, but look at the facts. And the facts are that most of this kind of activity is actually undertaken by the private sector. That's why you have these tender processes, because you're asking the private sector to bid competitively for a particular project to actually be undertaken. So there's no interference as far as I'm concerned. And you know, ultimately, nobody's going to ask who's board member number 8 on the Eskom board. when something happens. They're going to ask, who's the minister? Am I right? Because as far as the public is concerned, we are accountable. But at the same time, we know that corporate governance rules must be abided by. We're very aware of it. And I think the question of accountability was raised earlier on as well by Honorable Fidi. And on the one hand, we need to hold these entities and their board and management to account. And on the other hand, once they've stabilized the situation, they must run the show. Then, Mr. Marea, I can get a lot more rest than I'm getting at the moment. So then, as far as the other issues that the Honorable Piri raised, Chair, governance and management, we're slowly beginning to get that right. But whether it's in the department or whether it's in relation to these entities, we must see that we are in a transition mode. We're moving away from this past that was quite destructive to a point where we want to stabilize both the department and these entities. And so, for example, in Transnet, the processes of cleaning up started a little bit later, and you're going to find lots of acting names there, but the board is in the process of filling in many of those vacancies, but they have to go through their own processes. It's not for me to interfere with them, but I can actually phone the chair of the board from time to time and say, can we speed this thing up so that we have the kind of certainty that we actually require. So we're well on our way. Hopefully a lot of that will be done by the end of the year, and some of it will be done early in the new year. But we agree with you that we're not Hollywood or Bollywood or Nollywood, so we don't need too many acting positions, and we certainly share your concern in that regard. The shareholder management bill is what I think you were referring to. Hasn't actually been to cabinet, but we've got to rethink all of that, because that's a legacy out of the Pieta Commission that was in 2013 or something like that. If you remember, there was a review, and you might want to, as honorable members, look at that report. It's huge, but you can still look at it, on SOEs. And what are some of the measures that government needs to take into account that they had actually recommended. The President is in the process of establishing a Presidential SOE Council, and I think we might actually emerge with a different model arising out of that conversation. So we might not rush into formulating a bill when there's other changes that we might actually want to undertake. And we're learning a lot of lessons, Honorable Members, in the last year and a half about what works and what doesn't work. Every day is a new revelation. And every day we learn about different sectors of the economy and how we could possibly manage them as well. I think the NERSA issue was dealt with earlier on. The one thing that I wanted to add on the clean energy side, Chair, is we will sign off soon on an important project that Eskom will get involved in, which uses in large part a loan made by the World Bank to the construction of the Medupi power station, and that is the battery storage project. And it could become quite an important world-class project when it begins to get off the ground in the next year or so. But we'll give you more information once we actually have that. But I think for the rest, we've addressed many of your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. Honorable members, I can feel some, maybe they have slept while you were speaking, but let me take this opportunity to thank you for your coming to the portfolio committee. By the way, we were informed about the delay that you are still addressing the cabinet. But we appreciate that you came there and attended to this task. But also we would like to appreciate the presentation that was made by Ms. Mokololo, the DDG.
Makololo. Okay, she was very good. She presented it quite good. Therefore, she was equal to the task. No. I think if the intention of bonus is to reward good work, then let it be. But thank you very much. I think, honourable members, we reached the end of our session. Thank you, everybody, for the attendance. Yeah. Okay.
Chair, I think you've had many presentations on SAA, so you're not foreign to the understanding that SAA has been in financial difficulty for some time. I think in the last 10 or 12 years, SAA has only made a profit, and a small one at it, for 2 years. That's the first thing. The second thing is that it has the same problem as many of the other entities. Its cost structure is far higher than its revenue. The third factor that I need to remind you is a set of structural issues. We are what is called a end-of-hemisphere destination. We are at the right at the bottom of the globe, so to speak. We're not in a position like Addis Ababa or some of the Middle Eastern countries or the Gulf countries to be a hub from which to actually operate. We would be the same as Australia, New Zealand, Argentina, and so on. So that is a structural difficulty that we have to contend with. It doesn't have the capital base to, for example, buy new aircraft, which are more energy efficient. So we've recently given them consent to a lease from another airline, or two different airlines, a few what are called A350s, which are 25% more fuel efficient than the A330s or A340s that are currently in use. So sometimes when you sit on a plane, just look at the side, and you're looking at the bigger planes. Some of them have two engines and two engines. Others have one engine and one engine. And there's wide-bodied aircraft and there's narrow-bodied aircraft. So I'm learning about aircraft as well, not too much yet. But fuel efficiency is a critical factor. And if there's changes in oil prices, then there's changes in fuel prices. The other key structural factor that I'm sure you read about is that airlines all over the world operate on what they call very thin margins. Your profits are not very high, any airline in the world. Even the most efficient airlines, so-called, run on a very low profit margin. So if you have some mishap within the airline, you fall into a loss very quickly. If you have an extended strike or whatever the situation might be. And we've been working on all sorts of plans, but government has given lots of money in the last couple of years to SAA, starting, I think, in 2017, 5 billion rands, and another 5 billion rands, and recently another 5.5 billion rands. But it's obligations to pay some debt, but more importantly, its running costs are not covered by its revenue, and therefore these bailouts, if you like, have to be provided. But we today are in a position where the fiscus can't just afford to provide endless amounts of money. So there's two problems we have. The one is in relation to guarantees, because as you might know, our contingent liabilities, so every guarantee becomes a contingent liability. So government has actual debt with borrowed money, but if it guarantees Mr. Gumede's debt, then it comes onto your books as a contingent liability. And if you look at the more recent reports of some of the ratings agencies, they say from a little while ago, contingent liabilities are now red with the debt itself. So if you have a contingent liability of around 470 billion rands, 350 billion rands is for Eskom, three quarters of that has been used. That 470 gets added to the 2.5 or 2.6 trillion rands that is sitting on government books as a debt. So the Treasury, understandably, is very reluctant to give guarantees. Secondly, actual cash provision. There's some things that the Minister of Finance announced in the MTVPS, but it just helps the airline to manage if it remains stable. So those are one set of facts. The second is the strike as it is taking place at the moment. I met with two of the unions yesterday morning, not to negotiate salaries, that's not my job, but to interact with them, and I'll interact with the other unions as well as soon as I can. Reverse a bit. On the 22nd of July this year, I met all seven unions that are recognized in SAA as a group. And we had about a 2.5 hour discussion. And the discussion was about, do we all recognize that SAA as a group is in financial crisis? Do we all, can we agree that we will work with each other to, inverted commas, save the airline? Most unions very quickly agreed, but some hesitated and then eventually agreed as well. Yesterday we recommenced that process with two of the unions that are on strike, and I must say that the discussion was very cordial. They put forward a whole lot of propositions, and we thought we had at least some baseline agreement that we could work together in terms of ensuring that they become partners in the process with the board and the management team to get the airline in a better position. But the kind of statements that were issued about the safety of the aircraft and passengers is quite a damaging one. And I think must be condemned by yourselves and any sensible South African. However much you want to scare people, however much you want to promote the objectives of a strike, it is unfair, firstly, to lie, because it was a lie, right? And secondly, to undermine a key government asset, just because we have a squabble over wages. And the assurance I can give you, which is the assurance I've received from the board, is that there was nothing wrong. Those pilots were world-class pilots. The crew were absolutely well-trained crew, as they would be on any international flight. So let me say that on the record as well. The third is that not with, and I'll come back to the strike issue in a moment, is that SAA has been pretty good at making sure that as soon as it was possible, its international flights got off the ground, and that started happening from Sunday. So some of our colleagues who were at the BRICS meeting, for example, in Brazil, had great difficulty coming back because the Sao Paulo return flight didn't work on that particular day when they had finished. But so all international flights are now operational. I think six destinations on the African continent, so those are the regional flights, have also become operational. And I thought I heard the announcement this morning that as of tomorrow, some of the flights to Durban and to Cape Town will become operational as well. So we are trying to ensure that the SAA doesn't keep losing revenue, because grounding the plane means you're losing 50 million or so every day. So on the one hand, we say we want to save the airline, then we say we want wage increases, and we want to secure jobs, but you damage the financials of the company while we're doing that. And those things don't work work together. So the management team, under very stressful situations, have actually done pretty well to, and they're not picking people off the street. They are people who want to work. Which brings me to the next issue, which is that of intimidation of staff. I don't know, there was some press conference this morning, but I haven't had time to catch up with it. But intimidating people who want to go to work is wrong. and must also be condemned. If crew or pilots or anybody else who wants to go to work, they must be allowed to work. If those who want to strike and want to continue to strike, they must continue to do so and obey the strike rules of South Africa, which are in law about where you picket, at what distance you picket, and how you need to behave, etc. On the negotiations themselves, I just want to say that as much as possible, we will encourage all of the parties, notwithstanding some difficulties that they had late into the night yesterday, to get back to the negotiating table. I've just been informed as I was walking to this room that all sides have agreed to a mediator. So a mediator will come into operation soon, today, and look at finding an amicable solution. The challenge that we have, Chair, is that we don't have as much cash as we need in SAA, or not we, but SAA doesn't have enough cash to possibly even pay salaries at the end of the month if we don't get this act going. So not only are people not going to get increases, they might not even get their salaries. But as I leave this room, we'll try to make some efforts to see if it's possible to get some assistance in that particular regard. But it all depends on whether we can conclude some understanding. One of the things that that the management and board are trying to get an understanding on is that even if they agree to some kind of increase, there's no cash available now. So they'll have to come to some understanding about what is paid when and when money is available to actually pay it as well. But that's something that will begin to emerge in the course of the next 24 hours or so. So the bottom line is an appeal to all the parties there, particularly the unions, and I must pay particular commendation to the other unions that are more concerned about the Section 189, about the restructuring of the airline, about restructuring the staff composition at SAA, and that are still in the talking mode, because I think that talking is what is necessary to A, build trust, but B, also find a solution that will be commonly accepted by all. This decisions that are being made around the strike in an airline industry also creates lots of uncertainty on tourism. So people book 6 months in advance. They want to know, are they going to be able to fly in relation to their booking? So again, workers at SAA need to be mindful of the economic context in which they are operating. And once again, I think it's important for all of us to appeal to the unions to not damage the economy, which is about to begin to level off and begin to feel in the course of the next year the impact of all the different things that government and the private sector and they themselves as unions have been trying to do to give confidence that our economy will grow, that there will be more investment, and some of the measures that we've already decided will begin to have their impact in the course of the next year. So sooner rather than later, we need to give every SAA customer some assurances, which, and I'm sure you see it in the media, where people say, I don't know whether I can fly in a month, I don't know whether I can fly in 2 months. But if we don't settle some of these issues quickly enough, we'll have to, the board is operating under the Companies Act. And the board is required to make sure that it does not operate on a non-going concern basis. So it has fiduciary responsibilities in its own right as well. So that's another constraint that we actually face. We don't want to see a situation where there is an unnecessary deterioration in the way we deal with this group of entities under SAA, the group, whereas we could actually undertake a more systematic way of dealing with the future of SAA and and the kind of way in which some restructuring will have to happen to ensure the sustainability of the group as a whole. So I can give you the assurance that everything possible is being done to get talks going again today. I'll get an update a little later. But it requires good leadership from all sides. It requires that tempers be calmed and that we don't cause more damage in the process of looking for money in a situation where money is a very limited commodity at this point in time. But we'll keep you and the public informed, as I'm sure the board will, in terms of what progress we're making in this regard. But SAA, as it stands right now, is not in a good position, and something has to give on all sides. And that's the one thing that South Africans have got to get used to, that when you are in the current mode as we are, we've all got to, in the case of Eskom, coal suppliers must not make super profits. The original equipment manufacturers who supply equipment must not make super profits. So you don't use this to exploit the state and state institutions. And similarly, on the SAA side, we've all got to make sacrifices, you know, if we want to have a sustainable future for this entity in whatever form it actually takes. Because like there's changes on the energy side, there's also changes in the airline industry. Domestically, there's shifts between full-service airline treatment versus low-cost airlines being used and facilities being used as well. So there are dynamic changes that are occurring within the airline industry that we've got to also match in some kind of way. And we need to keep one or other entity within this group competitive, because they are competitors. We are an open market, and we've opened our skies to many, many airlines around the world, and you've got to now deal with the consequences of some of those changes. So let's move forward with some hope, but it's going to take a bit of hard work, and it is going to, as I say, take sacrifices on all sides as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. The meeting is over now.